you know that when you have a good hand and a plan that's working, you double down. And that's what this budget proposal does. It doubles down on the priorities that matter for the city and invests in a better tomorrow for all of us, all of Seattle.
Well, that's Mayor Bruce Harrell right there, breaking down his double down approach to the 2023 budget process for the city. What is he want to double down on? What proposals are likely to meet the most resistance from the city council? Plus, why are council members disagreeing about a downtown rezoning plan? And could you do without driving for an entire week? Maybe you already do. Maybe you're listening to this podcast as you're shuttling into work on public transit. Well, you have safe travels on this fine day, and I thank you very much for listening to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callanan. I'm a host on Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are my own, and my co-host is the one and only David Croman from the Seattle Times. And David, we can't really talk about the Mariners season anymore because they missed the playoffs, but the hot topic right now is catcher Cal Raleigh calling out the front office to invest more in the team. I wanted to ask you about this. What did you make of him laying down that challenge to Mariners management and then his apology for that call out just a day later? What do you got?
Yeah, I think he's right on the money, and he's pretty good at recognizing that he's a highly valuable player with a lot of who curries a lot of favor with the fan base, and so he's in a position to say stuff like that. I think his apology was to the coaches, but you didn't hear him apologize to the management. I think the point was made, and I'm happy he made it.
Fair enough. Sounds good to me. Well, thank you, David, as always, for joining me. Thank you to our background noise sponsor, City Grind Espresso, on the first floor of City Hall. Thanks also to our show patrons. Our shout out of the week goes to Linda, who has been a patron since the start of this year and a close watcher of City Hall. Linda, thank you for the support, the emails you send my way, and also, hey, if you want to be like Linda, why not? If you're listening, please become a patron. We are here to answer your questions about city politics, and for just $5 a month, you can actually get this highly sought-after Seattle News, Views, and Brews decal. These are so great, and I want to make sure that more people get them. Send in your photos of your sticker, too, when I send them to you. When they're out ranging in the wild on a coffee cup, something like that, we will feature them on our sticker shot segment, which you can see on Converge Media. Converge airs the video version of our podcast Wednesday nights at 7. Thank you, Converge. Thank you, Linda. Thanks, everybody out there. Let's get cooking with right here, right now. David, I wanted to follow up on the mayor's budget announcement from last week because the devil is always in the details here. Again, folks, this is a mid-biennium budget adjustment we're talking about here. No major changes to the budget really for the city. But the part, David, that jumped out at me was that after several promises of investing more in treatment services, after this very contentious drug use and drug possession law discussion over the past few weeks, those investments don't seem to be in this budget proposal. I'm seeing a $1.1 million investment in an opioid overdose response center, some funding for We Deliver Care, that outreach group on Third Avenue, some other downtown revitalizations plans, but that's about it. And I just wonder, David, if this portion here with treatment services is where the council might try to make some changes, if they can, in a tight budget year, to add some more services here, because that drug law vote really seems like a continuing political battlefield for the city.
Yeah, I think you're right that there was never going to be any sort of dramatic, huge investments in this budget. It's a combination of it being the middle of a two-year budget plus a really tight, the revenue is not what it used to be. This feels, sometimes we see mayors in their proposed budgets leave out things that they know that the city council is going to want to put back in or shift things around to accommodate. And it's a little bit of a, it's kind of a game because no one wants to be taking money from one thing and moving it somewhere else. So, I think sometimes the mayor's office, when they propose these budgets, sort of kick some of the most challenging questions to the city council. It's possible, as you said, that this is one of them. Could also be possible that recognition that they're not sure exactly where that money would be spent right now. I'm not in that world deeply enough to know, which organizations are lined up to receive more treatment dollars or what that looks like. But, I know it's a sort of narrow field out there. So, you want to have a target for where that money's going to land.
Right. And I guess I mentioned that part, you know, if the council can make some changes to the budget, because dollars are definitely tight. This appears to be a stable but not rapidly growing economy, certainly, as we saw before the pandemic there. And the mayor, in terms of talking about revenue, is saying, okay, we're going to boost some parking rates to bring in some more dollars there. There are some investments in police. I want to make sure I mention that, to get 13 more officers, also police alternatives, plus some pay bumps for human service workers. But there was one piece here, David, I didn't see anything speaking to the $200 million annual budget gap expected over the next budget process starting next year, which I guess means the mayor wants to tackle that after the November elections. I just feel like that's a big, big elephant in the room, this idea of a big, big budget gap coming in the years ahead. And I just wanted your take on that. Why was that not mentioned in the mayor's budget? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think because they can put it off a little bit longer, so maybe they will. And I suppose there's some hope that the revenue forecast will improve. You know, who knows, maybe inflation stops in dead in its tracks and the Fed decides to reverse course and lower interest rates or something like that, you know, that could spur more investment and therefore close the, you know, improve the forecast a little bit. So possible they're in a bit of a wait and see mode, but at the same time, you know, if that doesn't happen, and it seems like it would be a surprisingly positive turn if that did happen, then you know, it's going to make it harder next year. I think it does make it easier for Mayor Harrell in an election year, for sure. So, you know, I don't think there are any easy answers to come for the city's budget over the next year and a half or whatever it is.
And I did want to ask, too, I know you've been tracking what's going on with transportation investments for the city. Anything jump out at you there when it comes to SDOT and what the city wants to do or what the mayor's proposing there?
The only thing that I suppose jumps out is what's not there, which is there's no money for studying the streetcar more. The mayor's office had sort of tried to get an extra $1 million during the mid-year supplemental budget. The city council struck that. It's kind of killed by the members who are streetcar skeptical, we'll say. And this budget doesn't do anything to bring that money back. We have been sort of doing a is it alive, is it dead game with the streetcar here for almost 10 years. You know, not quite ready to pronounce time of death, but without any money in this budget and looking at, like you just said, a $200 million gap that they're going to have to probably close in the next one, you know, it's really hard to imagine how a streetcar downtown ever gets built at this pace, because, you know, every year that goes by and it appears that another year will go by, the cost of this thing goes up. You know, we talk about when to pronounce it dead. I'm not quite there yet, but without the streetcar money there, there's just no momentum behind it at this point.
Yeah, I wonder if the Move Seattle levy would be willing to take on something like that. Definitely we'll have to see, but that's not a vote of confidence from the mayor for sure for a project that has been so contentious for so long. There's one other budget issue, sidebar here, I guess, I wanted to touch on with you here, David. The amount of federal funding for COVID recovery. Remember this, folks, about $300 million came to Seattle from ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act. Well, this funding has just about dried up, but the council took a long look at this last week, found that about a third of that funding has gone to housing and homeless services, 27% to supporting city workers. There's money for business recovery that's gone out, childcare too. About $42 million of this funding remains as of this moment, but it has to be allocated or budgeted by the end of next year and spent by 2026. David, I brought this up because I think this has an impact on the budget process too. Programs that came online or maybe were sustained by this one-time ARPA funding, what happens to those in 2024 and beyond? What a juggling act for the city council here.
Yeah, and this comes up every year. There are programs that get funded with one-time expenditures or revenue streams that are designed to decrease, like the soda tax or whatever it might be. And, you know, I think every year the budget office kind of raises concerns about this. But so far, the city has kind of been able to push it down the road a little bit because up until a couple of years ago, the revenue forecasts were always good, so they could re-up the funding on those. I do think at some point there will be a reckoning on a lot of that one-time funding. And, you know, this isn't going to be unique to Seattle. A lot of governments and businesses and just, you know, public agencies were propped up by federal spending. you know, you look at transit, for example, it's going to maybe not as much in Washington State, but for a lot of transit sure. agencies, looking at a cliff when a lot of this stuff runs out. And so it's not unique to Seattle. It doesn't mean it's easy to handle. Are people stable enough? Did it sort of serve its purpose to stabilize people and get out, or did it start to become kind of a permanent program? If the latter, it's a little more difficult to extract.
Right. And I just think about this in the overall budget process going forward, David. When you consider that there are going to be a majority of new faces on that city council come next year, and when you talk about these big budget challenges ahead of them, I'm not saying they're not capable, but when you have a group of council members who don't have a lot of elected experience there, I just wonder what happens with this budget process next year. I have some concerns and questions about it. I know we're going to have a lot of new energy on the council, if you want to call it that. But I also wonder about that. What's that process going to be like for a council next year that's going to have a majority of new members?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly will mean that a lot of the sort of grand visions that I'm sure that we have, and I'm sure we'll continue to hear on the campaign trail, will not be realized because they're going to inherit a thin budget. I mean, this is going to be, I mean, probably the best people you could ask about what this is going to be like are the city council members of, you know, 2010 or whatever it might have been. Because that's probably
right,
it's going
right,
to
right.
resemble that more than it is going to resemble most of the last 10 years. So, you know, on the bright side, it's in some ways coming into a position of authority when things are bad is not bad for you politically speaking, yeah. because you know, no one's going to blame you for the sure. position, and you can kind of only go up from there. So if you're looking for a silver lining, it's that.
All right. Fair enough. We'll see where that pans out. But David, thank you for breaking down that piece. There's a lot more ahead with this, with the budget, and we'll be covering it over the next couple of weeks here, folks. All right. Well, take a look at this. We're going to be looking at a promise to end homelessness downtown. It never came through. The plans for the Partnership for Zero group, what happens to them now? That's coming up on Now Hear This. Well, a short while ago, the group Partnership for Zero, a public-private partnership of philanthropists and government leaders led by the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, announced it was winding down its plans to reduce functional homelessness in the downtown Seattle core to zero. The KCRHA says it will lay off 38 people this week who are working on that program. That plan was to reach that zero number by sometime in 2023. As former Authority CEO Mark Dones told me on Seattle Channel in November of 2022, when the downtown core homeless count was at about 770 people.
So to be within a month at about 115 households are in the process of getting key documents, I feel good about that work.
Okay.
And if we can hold that pace, I think that when we are having this conversation, you know, hopefully end of summer next year, we'll be looking at a very different downtown.
So the Partnership for Zero did not maintain that pace, and we still have functional homelessness in the downtown core, of course. And David, I just wanted to get your take on how this plan to end Partnership for Zero, how does that impact the RHA, the county and city? We're clearly disappointed here. And then the philanthropists, too, I'm guessing might be saying, hey, what'd you do with my money? What do you think about all this, this whole idea of ending the Partnership for Zero?
Yeah, I think this is pretty devastating to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. You know, I don't know how much of its workload this partnership was supposed to be exactly, but you know, I mean, it was really public. I think this is a body that has not inspired, I think, a lot of confidence in basically anybody. The elected officials, the public, you know, I mean, to kind of come out and have this big announcement of this public-private partnership and come up with a really specific goal as far as ending downtown homelessness, which I think people appreciate that. You have a, you know, I think a lot of times the response to homelessness can feel a little amorphous. And so having something so specific as this, I think is good for people. But to have it then end like this, I imagine really sort of cast doubt on what exactly this new governmental body is doing and what its plan is going forward.
Yeah. And I just wanted to ask, too, as the RHA tries to get out of the hole it's clearly dug for itself, how do their struggles impact the county and city budget processes? Because I would imagine the city and county would feel a little less supportive of the authority, but I know the RHA is still providing some crucial services. They want this to work. Any thoughts about what this or how this impacts the city and county budget process?
You know, I do know that Mayor Harrell in the past, in some comments that were published online has expressed, you know, skepticism or has basically grumbled a little bit about how much money the city is sending to the RHA. So we know that he is not like really sold on this as a response to homelessness. I frankly don't know what that means in the short term. But I imagine it's not like this funding, I think, is going to be guaranteed in perpetuity by any stretch.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really, really interesting back and forth for the RHA this fall. And we'll see what happens into the wintertime, too, which is when a lot of these services for the homeless are so needed. So we'll keep an eye on that story for sure and what happens with those budgets there and the budget asks for the RHA as well. But I wanted to move on to another story here with you here, David. Check on a story from last week that caused a little consternation on the council and a split vote, too, to boot. So there was this zoning proposal from the mayor, which we've talked about over this past month in the podcast, it including putting in high-rise housing on 3rd Avenue. And this got some pushback on the council. It was a split 6-3 vote to approve this plan. They did end up approving it, but here are the no votes. Councilmember Peterson was a no vote. Says, too much of a developer giveaway. Councilmember Morales, don't always talk about those two in the same breath. She said no because she wants more affordable housing. Councilmember Sawant voted no as well. David, your take on 3rd Avenue. What does a rezone there to allow for more high-rise housing do for that neighborhood? We are talking about the Blade, as it's known, a neighborhood that is infamous for all the drug activity going on there. What impact will rezoning have?
Well, its intended impact is to attract investment and to make that stretch basically more welcoming, more livable. And the thought being, if you can do bigger buildings there and put more apartments, you know, maybe you have things like the apartment building that is over the target. You know, the thought is kind of help revitalize that stretch. I think the rezone is, I mean, it's the actual vote on the rezone is real, but its effects are pretty theoretical at this point because doesn't seem to be, at least not from what I can glean from the coverage in the Seattle Times, doesn't sound like there's a ton of like developer interest right now to buy up and redevelop those buildings.
Right.
Because that's what it comes down to. You know, that said, with this rezone in place, if you are a developer interested in building down there, it's now a slightly less intimidating project. You know, sometimes when developers want to do something, they actually have to go and ask for the rezone. The rezone is in place now. But given sort of where we are in time with a lot of questions about downtowns and commercial real estate, all that, and also given where this location is physically on 3rd Avenue, which has got its troubles, well documented, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what it would take for a developer to want to take on a project like that.
Yeah. Fair. And I wanted to throw out another flyer here. I thought it was interesting within this proposal. There are also incentives for developers to build a new downtown school. And I know there's been talk about that for a long time in the city of Seattle, but here we are with a school district in the midst of budget cuts of its own there. I'm not sure if this idea is going to get any love. The downtown school idea, David, I know this has been brought up before. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think kind of one of the essential, I don't know if I would call it a problem, but one of the essential things that I would say a lot of city leaders want to change about downtown is that it is, that it's not enough of a neighborhood, frankly, that it's mm-hmm. got businesses and it's got tourism. But the pandemic sort of exposed the fragility of those two things when no yeah. one was going into businesses and all the, you know, into the office and all the businesses kind of struggled mightily as a result. And then, you know, yeah. 3rd Avenue has always had its troubles, but I think once those emptied out, then it really had a lot of problems. And so
yeah.
I think the ideal, if you were to ask people, is you turn downtown, you know, it's still a commercial core, it's still a tourist core, but it's also got some more vibrancy for people who just live down there.
Yeah. And there are a lot more people who live there now. I mean, I think it's important to point that out.
No, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it is the densest place to live in the city. Its reputation, though, I mean, especially along 3rd Avenue, is not as a yeah. neighborhood. And I think for families, you know, a couple sort of difficult things about living down there is access to grocery stores and access to schools. Mm-hmm. You know, more grocery stores, you know, PCC opened, and of course there's Pike Place Market. But I think a school, the thought is that would make it more realistic to actually live down there. I don't know. I think there's sort of a general goal for downtown that most people agree on. It's all the steps that it takes to get there that bit of a question mark.
Yeah, no, I'm interested to see it because that has always been a tender area, as you mentioned, for the city. And the hope is, I guess, that some building would change some of that dynamic down there. Will it change it? Will it move these types of issues elsewhere, as we have seen in the past? I think that remains to be seen. So an initiative by the city to try to make some changes on 3rd Avenue by changing the built environment there. We'll see how that one pans out. All right, well, coming up, how would you fare in a week without driving? I am quizzing Seattle's most brilliant transportation reporter. David, that's you. Coming up on Transportation Talk. David, I wanted to talk about a story I noticed on a few different news outlets. This first week of October marks the annual Week Without Driving. This is an event that Disability Rights Washington began in 2021, and it's all about drawing attention to the inequity suffered by people who do not have the ability to drive, including many disabled people who have to rely on transit or other options. Now, this started in our state. Apparently, it has gone national now. I've noticed Seattle Department of Transportation Director Greg Spotts is taking part in this, purposely not driving this week. What do you make of this week, David, and what impact is going to come out of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an important thing for people who are used to driving because, you know, I think right now a lot of the non-driver facilities are sort of struggling. Metro buses don't show up, service is delayed, Sound Transit, light rails often delays or construction happening in the stations. You look at, we've written about sidewalks a bunch, getting around, that's hard to experience unless you're in a wheelchair or have a stroller or something like that. But you get a sense for kind of the state of sidewalks a little bit better and how poor of a shape they are in and what that means for people who don't drive. Mm-hmm. I think people, especially policymakers, draw a lot of their decision makings on personal experience. I think this is probably more targeted toward them than the general public. I don't know how many people out there in the world are choosing to, who are not already kind of involved with the stuff, are choosing not to drive specifically in this week. But it is something that I think is targeted at a lot of elected officials. And, in like any sort of good lobbying effort, it sort of keeps these issues at the top of their minds. And, this bill was introduced before the Week Without Driving, but we've seen some motion in city council just around sidewalk repairs and things like that. So, sure. As far as the effect goes, I don't think anyone's going to say it's going to transform local government's thinking overnight, but it is, it's a form of activism that I think has shown, it's been a few years now, and I think it has shown some staying power, and you can see that based on news coverage and who's participating in it. It's a fairly significant number of elected officials.
It sure seems like it. And I guess in terms of what they're going to see, David, it feels like a lot of the things you've been reporting on, sidewalks is certainly one of them, as we've talked about on the podcast. But it's things like, hey, we don't have enough people who are doing maintenance on our buses. We don't have, enough routes covered here. We don't have enough ferry boats going out, et cetera. I'm just trying to figure out the different problems that are going to be most glaring when elected officials, as you say, really try to go a week without driving.
Yeah, I would think... riding a bus. I mean, if you haven't ridden a King County Metro bus in a while, then maybe you don't understand just the frustration that people are feeling about reliability and as traffic has come back, delays. So, that's something that, especially on, transit boards like Sound Transit or in King County Council, that's something that I think a lot of advocates really want to see. The people who serve on those boards actually use the services that they are governing, because without that, you won't ever truly know kind of what's happening out there on the street.
Yeah, accurate. All right. Well, David, we need to wrap up here. Thank you, as always, sir, for joining me on the program here. I wanted to ask you about your World Series winner. I need you to think about that for a second. If your answer is the Astros, of course, you're dead to me, but I need to put that out there. Who you got, man? What do you think?
It seems like it never is this clean, but you know, I don't know how you bet against the Braves, so I'm going Braves.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And I'd love to see those, that upstart Orioles crew do something with 100 wins on the season. They
that's who I want.
Fun to watch.
That's who I want to win is the Orioles. Who I think will win is the Braves.
Yeah, yeah, I got you. They are super powerful this year. Well, we shall see what happens there, David. We got a few weeks to argue about that one, too. Thank you, as always, for joining me. Thanks to everyone listening to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. This podcast is on Apple, Spotify, wherever you like to listen. Please find Seattle News, Views, and Brews on Patreon and show your support. Thanks for watching on Converge Media as well. We will see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2023.